ready to see his favorite band play live. He's thought about it all week. He bought his ticket. He wore his band t-shirt. He went to the concert venue. He wasn't allowed inside the concert venue. He put away his band t-shirt. He threw away his ticket. And he thought about it all week.
Don't wait until it hits you. Get vaccinated. Beginning in September, you'll need a vaccination passport to enter certain public spaces. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the MondoWise Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Reed. At MondoWise, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. In this episode, MondoWise founder and senior editor Phil Weiss speaks to Khaled El-Gindi about the first meeting between President Joe Biden and newly installed Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. Earlier this year, Bennett joined centrist politician Yair Lapid to build an unusual coalition of right-wing, centrist, and liberal political parties to topple Benjamin Netanyahu. This government marks the first time Palestinian-Israeli political parties are included in a governing coalition. Bennett is a far-right political figure opposed to Palestinian statehood and ending settlement expansion, and he's focused on Iran as the greatest threat to Israeli security. Khaled El-Gindi is a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, where he directs the program on Palestine and Israeli-Palestinian affairs. Prior to that, he was a fellow in the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution. El-Gindi was an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and he was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations of 2007 and 2008. He is the author of the book Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians, From Balfour to Trump.
Khaled, thanks for getting on this call. I want to discuss with you the Biden-Bennett summit of last week. I realize this is a little bit off your expertise in that your book and that came out a couple of years ago, Blind Spot, is about U.S.-Palestinian relations. And this is a case that we're discussing, well, obviously a big part of your book, but the U.S.-Israeli relationship. You are a scholar at the Middle East Institute, and I'm hoping to get your reaction to what happened on Friday, what the significance of that long-awaited meeting between the U.S. president and the Israeli prime minister, what the significance of that is, and and particularly with respect to the Palestinian future?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Phil. It's good to be with you. Just a quick point, you know, obviously, yeah, my focus has been on U.S.-Palestinian relations, but it's impossible, as you know, to talk about the U.S. and the Palestinians without looking at Israel. I mean, it is a relationship defined and first and foremost by it's really an outgrowth of the U.S.-Israel relationship. It's a byproduct more than it is a relationship in and of itself. So it's impossible to look at the Palestinian issue without obviously looking at Israeli politics and the U.S.-Israel bilateral relationship. As far as the meeting last Friday, I think it generally, there were no real surprises. I think it was really about the optics more than anything else. The substance of the relationship is, I think, fairly constant. Even when there is a rocky relationship between the president and the prime minister of Israel. And so this was really about, you know, as Prime Minister Bennett put it, it's about turning a new page. It's about, closing that chapter of the Netanyahu era and beginning a new chapter. From the standpoint of a personal relationship between a different prime minister and a different U.S. president. And I think they both went out of their way to stress the, unshakable, unbreakable bonds between the two countries. We heard a lot of standard talking points in the press conference that was held in the Oval Office. And so this was really about, you know, demonstrating the strength of the relationship and putting it on new footing and turning the page on the Netanyahu era.
I agree with what you've said based on my reading of the press, that there were no surprises and that the chief element of this is, as you described, this turning of the page. Were there small surprises to you? And related, the great pleasure of the Israel lobby organizations, the pro-Israel organizations, in the apparent good feeling between these two guys who have so much power, are the Israel pro-Israel groups right to be deriving satisfaction from this discussion?
I mean, I do think that the generally positive optics that were intended came through. I mean, that was, you know, the goal from an Israeli or pro-Israel standpoint was to demonstrate that the closeness of the relationship is not limited to a right-wing Israeli prime minister and a right-wing American president, but that it is bipartisan in nature. You have a very right-wing Israeli prime minister and a, you know, established, you know, sort of centrist Democrat as a president. And so it's important, given where the presidential debate was, given the dissension inside the Democratic Party, particularly among the progressive wing, who are talking about conditioning aid to Israel and upholding Palestinian rights. That's created a bit of a crisis inside the Democratic Party and a lot of angst for the pro-Israel crowd what many people see as the demise of what we used to call the bipartisan consensus on Israel. And so this was one way to demonstrate that bipartisan consensus is still very much in place. Whether it is or isn't, of course, is a different matter. It's much deeper than the meeting between two individuals. You still do have dissension inside the Democratic Party when it comes to Israel and Palestine. But as far as the optics are concerned, I think it went the way it was supposed to go as choreographed.
I noted that I believe Palestinians were mentioned only once in passing in Biden's commentary on his statement about the meeting. Can you give us a sense of how Palestinians feel or should feel about their prospect for any sort of rights in Israel and Palestine, and particularly in the occupied territories, on the basis of what happened in Washington?
Yeah, I mean, I can't really speak for Palestinians, but I think it's not a surprise also that the Palestinian issue was marginal in this summit between the two leaders. It's not a priority for either leadership, not for the Biden administration, and certainly not for the Bennett government. The Palestinian issue is precisely the sort of issue that can bring down this very fragile, you know, broad coalition that Bennett and Lapid are ruling over. So both the Biden administration and the Bennett government have an interest in pushing aside the Palestinian issue. And so I don't think Palestinians will be surprised to hear that. I think especially after the crisis in May, both the violence in Jerusalem and in Gaza, that was clearly on display. That, you know, the Biden administration in particular is not really interested in even dealing with the sort of, you know, second tier issues like home demolitions and expulsions and settlements. Never mind the very dicey issues of, you know, final status like Jerusalem and sovereignty and Palestinian statehood. Those are clearly off the table. But even the more limited issues of conflict mitigation or conflict management is something that the Biden administration isn't really interested in dealing with. And I think beyond, of course, we don't know what was said privately, but I imagine it was more than what was said publicly about the Palestinians. I'm sure there was a reference to Gaza. There was probably a reference to the expulsions in Jerusalem, and trying to generally make life better for Palestinians. But beyond that, I don't think Palestinians really have much to expect from either of these two leaders.
U.S. policy is for a two-state solution. Bennett said pointedly to the New York Times ahead of this meeting, there will never be a Palestinian state. Is that going to be a source of tension going forward between these two countries under these two administrations, in your view? And also, what is the status of that two-state solution right now? Two big questions.
Yeah, I mean, on the first part of your the first question, no, I don't think it's going to be a source of tension. I think if there are any potential sources of tension, it will be, related to the Palestinians. It will be on things like the expulsions and perhaps another round of fighting in Gaza that this administration will seek to avoid. But those are likely to be mild and probably not on public display. There will be, concerns will most likely be conveyed privately and, rather than in the public sphere. So, there isn't an ideological dispute here. It's not a source of tension. Mm-hmm. I think the Biden administration very well understands that Bennett is ideologically opposed to a two-state solution, and it's not a problem at all. I mean, they both have gone out of their way to demonstrate that the U.S.-Israel partnership and alliance is as strong as ever, and it's not going to, unlike the situation with the Palestinians, the peace process has never been the U.S.-Israel relationship is not conditioned in any way, really on anything, but it's certainly not conditioned on success or failure of the peace process. That's the exact opposite of the relationship with the Palestinians. But Palestinians are only relevant in the context of a peace process from the standpoint of U.S. policy. So, Netanyahu was working against two states, and he he also said that a two-state solution will not happen on my watch. So that's not new, and that's not going to provoke any sort of crisis. As far as, you know, that does, I think, kind of beg the question of where things stand as far as the two-state solution is concerned. You know, I think to a large extent, the question of whether a two-state solution is still viable is sort of a philosophical debate, really. It really just depends on what people think is theoretically possible and doable, more than it is to some, you know, it's not connected to, you know, necessarily to realities on the ground. If you look at realities on the ground, it's very hard to conclude that a two-state solution is still achievable. But of course, theoretically, you could have potentially at some point down the road, a new Israeli government that is willing to divide Jerusalem and cede sovereignty over the West Bank to and the Gaza Strip to the Palestinians. Is that likely? I think it's highly unlikely, particularly given the context in Israeli politics, which are, you know, notwithstanding this current coalition government that is quite broad and includes some left-wing elements, the reality is that Israeli politics are pretty much dominated by the right. The Israeli Knesset has a very, very solid right-wing majority. And for the most part, you know, the consensus in Israeli politics about two states has collapsed. It's really only the purview of the Arab parties and the left, the few leftist parties in the fringe. So that in and of itself sort of argues against the viability of a two-state solution. But, you know, since politics and diplomacy hate a vacuum, the United States and the international community will continue to adhere to the goal of two states until something else replaces it, even if it's no longer physically or politically achievable.
I want to get to that question, and I don't want to keep you too long, but I want to get to that question of the discourse that may be replacing the two-state solution in a second. But I first want to ask you about words that you used earlier in this discussion, conflict management. It's a very important way, in my view, of understanding Israeli policy. And yet, even people who are tuning into this podcast who know this these issues well may not fully understand what conflict management means. You used it. You said this is Bennett's. This is what Bennett is doing. Can you explain what that means? And also, if you don't mind, if you care to, inject a moral framework on that or a human rights framework. Whether it's a good or bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, what I mean by conflict management is the goal of containing basically violent outbursts on both or either side, not resolving these longstanding core issues like Jerusalem and refugees and statehood, but rather trying to prevent you know, violent outbreaks or to mitigate them. Or to sort of diminish their kind of spillover effect. For example, the roadmap of 2003 was a conflict management initiative. It was designed to, you know, take the parties, to disengage them. Both sides had obligations as far as tamping down on violence or incitement. And there was also steps that both sides needed to take in order to get back to a political process to try to resolve the conflict. So conflict management is just this very broad term of, you know, trying to prevent violence in a systematic way. Now, it means different things to different people. So For example, the Israeli army or security forces might decide that the way to manage conflict is through repression. If we arrest large numbers of Palestinians, if we use live ammunition against protesters, this will be enough of a disincentive for people to go home and stay quiet and keep the calm. So that's one model of conflict management, which many dictatorships use, and that is trying to maintain calm through repression. That's unlikely to work, and it really hasn't worked in any context, more often than not, because of increasing casualties. It just acts as an exacerbator of conflict. And so this is why you need, you know, the Israeli version of conflict management, and there's probably a spectrum even on the Israeli side, should be subordinated really to third parties. This is why you bring in third parties to act as mediators, because they supposedly will insist that both sides have to meet certain obligations and take certain steps to de-escalate and to prevent violence, ideally within the framework of some other plan to bring about, or at least keep possible, a political resolution. But we don't have that happening. This administration is not even all that interested in conflict management. It's certainly not interested in conflict resolution. I think that's where the danger is, because they're inclined to defer conflict management to the Israelis and say, do whatever you got to do to keep things calm, whether it's allowing more economic activity or even security action, because we don't really have a plan. This administration doesn't have a vision for what conflict management looks like.
Thank you. That's very helpful and fascinating. Just one last, bite of the apple here. Am I allowed to derive some kind of cynical satisfaction from the fact that these people are arguing about whether there can even be an American consulate for Palestinians in Jerusalem? I mean, that's the facts on the ground that Trump established or Biden is accepting. I mean, I need to throw that in before we end up here.
I'm not sure I follow the thrust of your question. I mean, is it, there is that debate happening. I don't know how hard this administration is going to push. We know that the Bennett government doesn't want to reopen the consulate. We also know that the Biden administration has not fully repudiated the Trump agenda on a whole set range of issues, including on settlements. We haven't seen a formal reversal of some of those policies that Trump put in place. Maybe they're going to happen. Maybe they're on the agenda, or maybe they won't. There has not been like a full-throated repudiation of Trump's vision. I'm not sure how hard they're going to push on things like the consulate in Jerusalem.
Thank you. I appreciate that PS.
Okay, great. Thanks for
great
having me. Good luck.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to our show, a production of MondoWise.net. The music is from Sound of Picture. Visit our site to sign up for free daily and weekly newsletters on Palestine, Israel, and related U.S. politics. Thank you.
This is Rethinking Palestine, a podcast from Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. We are a virtual think tank that aims to foster public debate on Palestinian human rights and self-determination. We draw upon the vast knowledge and experience of the Palestinian people, whether in Palestine or in exile, to put forward strong and diverse Palestinian policy voices. In this podcast, we will be bringing these voices to you so that you can listen to Palestinians sharing their analysis wherever you are in the world. The US has long been a supporter and an ally of Israel, not only diplomatically, but also through military and financial means since its establishment. Indeed, Israel is vital for the US's imperial and capitalist interests in the Middle East. And this relationship has played a key role in shaping the politics of the region ever since. But it's also long been under scrutiny by progressives, human rights organizations, and those on the left. In particular, there has been a focus on military aid. And in more recent years, this particular topic has been gaining momentum, especially within activist spaces in the US, who are putting the question to the mainstream public. Why should billions of taxpayers' dollars go to a foreign state which is occupying and oppressing another people? And this has also seeped into discussions within the political institutions, and we're seeing more US politicians, not loads, but certainly more, question that military aid. To discuss this and more, I'm joined by Nadia Tanous, who is a Palestinian organizer and Ashabaka's visiting US fellow, and is working specifically on this topic for us. Nadia, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Yara.
Nadia, can you start by contextualizing US military aid to Israel and giving us a bit of a historical background?
So since Israel's establishment in the region in 1948, the US has largely shaped its relationship to the Middle East North Africa region through maintaining security and leverage for Israel and its supporters. So as we track the policy decisions of the new Biden administration, it is important to remember that the US has never wavered from upholding Israel's hegemony in the region. It's a pretty entry-level idea and fact, but it's an important one. The basics are important because it's really what underpins a lot of the decisions that the United States are making, the calculations that they're making in the region, and also, of course, the legislation that's coming out in support of military aid.
Nadia, you illuminated how the US has always maintained this kind of aid, and it's really been bipartisan. Can you explain what it means when US policy makers across the board talk about Israel's qualitative military edge, the QME?
The QME, or the qualitative military edge, ensures Israel's military advantage in the region in both military technologies and weaponry. And it's as specifically as the preferred partner of the United States in the region, and clearly as a proxy state for US interests. So that's what it means at the basic level. It's an agreement that's long established in US practice. It's been enshrined in US legislation since 2008, but it's enforced through the United States congressional discretion. And so that's important. Something that I talk about in the brief is a bill that Representative Schneider out of Illinois proposed, which is H.R. 8494. He proposed it in the fall around November of last year. And what's really important to note, the bill was titled Guaranteeing Israel's Qualitative Military Edge. And what's important to note is that it was brought forward in the clamor of Zionist anxieties about the integrity of Israel's QME in light of the deal of the century, in light of the Abraham Accords, where you see the same U.S. weapon sales that are given to Israel as a preferential partner every year are now being offered up to Arab client states. And that would create potentially, at least on paper, the ability for them to access the same level of firepower as Israel. So Schneider's bill calls into question the integrity of Israel's QME and says, wait a minute, isn't Israel the U.S. preferred partner in the region? Why are these Arab states who are normalizing now, at least on paper, going to be guaranteed the same level of weaponry? I think just to highlight how ridiculous Schneider's bill was, and I want to remind us that it was co-sponsored by 19 other representatives. The bill was not significant because it was, again, backing Israel's hegemony in the region. We know that this is a consistent facet of most of all U.S. policy and most legislation that reaches Senate and Congress. But it was significant because it proposed that Israel itself, not U.S. Congress, would hold the deciding power over U.S. weapons deals across the entire Middle East, North Africa region. And that's a big deal because at its core, it is removing the decision power for weapon sales from U.S. Congress and putting them in the hands of the Israeli state. This is something, Yara, that I think is exceptional to Israel. I cannot think of any other nation where you would have a U.S. representative willingly propose to sign over the United States's largest international money-making mechanism, which of course is selling of weapons and technologies of control, and putting that in the hands of a foreign nation. I think this just exemplifies both the current and existential anxiety by Zionists and Israel supporters that any other country, but particularly Arab nations, would receive the same caliber as weapons as the Israeli state from their U.S. supplier. And I think that's because Israel and its supporters know that Israeli hegemony is reliant upon this international prioritization and U.S. support, unparalleled military might. And so I think existentially, Schneider and others were processing, everything is fine now between the UAE and Israel, Bahrain and Israel, Saudi Arabia and Israel. But if it weren't, and these Arab nations have the same weaponry as Israel itself, or they're armed with equal military weapons, what are the stakes? So I think they're in this very funny kind of existential tussle, but it's really shocking that this bill not only made it to Congress, but it also had 19 other signatories who were also U.S. representatives.
Nadia, I wanted to ask you if you could talk to us a little bit more about how this kind of aid has become such a key factor in the regional dynamics between Israel and Arab states and between the Arab states and Palestine.
So one of the main ways that the U.S. maintains security for Israel is by brokering peace deals between Arab state governments and the Israeli government. And this directly pressures Arab nations to capitulate to Israeli needs through a variety of mechanisms. So rescinding U.S. military aid is one threat. A benefit can be graduating Arab states to be preferred recipients of support from bodies such as the IMF or the World Bank. And finally, the U.S. invoking advantageous international trade deals and either U.S. arms trade, military support, etc. So we can see this, you know, the first two Arab countries that normalized with Israel were, of course, Egypt in 1979 and Jordan in 1994. And we know that Trump hearkened in a new era of U.S. brokered normalization treaties under the banner of the Abraham Accords, which I might casually refer to as the deal of the century, which was signed by the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan. And this all happened, it all took place while Palestinians were weathering constant settler attacks, the bombing of besieged Gaza. It directly implicates Palestine because the accords directly undercut Palestinian demands for self-determination. And they normalize Israeli state violence. In many ways, these countries in the Arab region signing on and entering this agreement between the United States and Israel served as a green light for Israel to continue its ethnic cleansing campaign with impunity, as it has. And so I think it's important also to contrast the Arab normalization and the military aid to Israel with Israeli policies on the ground, which are happening concurrently, like the Jerusalem 2020 plan, the Marin plan, which aimed to expel the remaining Palestinian population from Jerusalem altogether. And I can certainly talk more about the implications and the specifics of some of these offers from the United States through the deal of the century, etc. But I think just to finish up this thought, you know, today, Egypt is the second largest recipient of U.S. military aid after Israel. And Jordan benefits from one of the strongest currencies in the world, which is the Jordanian dinar. And these are both benefits that are reaped by these Arab nations because of their initial normalization treaties with Israel. So for the UAE and Bahrain, for example, they will be the recipients of a first-rate arms deal. And that's really where this brief comes in, is to analyze the aftermath of this wave of normalization treaties on Palestine and the Arab nations who are beneficiaries of the agreement, and to kind of analyze and support the pushback against them. I know you asked about Israeli military aid and the history. I think what we're seeing explicitly yet again are Arab nations buying into that routine U.S. Package to Israel by signing up for their own and saying, okay, we're going to now publicly toss aside the Palestinian cause, whether or not they were doing so implicitly, right? Previously, we're going to publicly toss it aside and say that in return, we are expecting these mass benefits. And in this case, it really is a first-rate arms deal, which, as we know, is majority of what the U.S. aid to Israel also is. It's the creme de la creme, top of the line arms deal to the state of Israel for both its interest against the Palestinians and oppressing the Palestinians, and also to bolster its regional interests, particularly as a favored partner of the United States.
Nadia, you've really laid out so clearly how this just isn't about Israel and how it's connected so much to regional dynamics. Now, I wanted to move globally. Recently, we've seen a convergence of global grassroots movements, which have included vocal solidarity with Palestine. And these movements and activists have been challenging the US business as usual policy when it comes to Israel. And there are now more and more people globally calling for conditioning, sanctioning, and halting US military aid to Israel. How has that come about, and what does it look like on the ground in the US?
I can start with a recent example of this. So we have both become used to Israel's preferential treatment and the constant restocking of their weaponry through U.S. aid. And I guess before I start this comment, I want to honor the longstanding vocal supporters of Palestinian dignity and self-determination who have always spoken out against these policies. Even though it's expected, we know that it is unjust to let the United States and Israel carry on with business as usual. But realistically, in the previous years, those numbers of vocal supporters for Palestine were much lower or much quieter than they are now in the United States. So I think that in light of the developments on the ground in Palestine during the Unity Intifada, and for the U.S. context still being in the shadow of the George Floyd and Breonna Taylor uprisings, some of the pushbacks from the grassroots level really caught on at the congressional level. So on May 5th, Congress was notified of the $735 million commercial sale of precision-guided weapons to Israel, which initiated a 15-day period when Congress members may object, and that's routine. So what happened then between May 5th and May 20th was gruesome. It was an onslaught of Israeli colonial violence, including airstrikes on Gaza that killed 243 Palestinians. And at the tail end of the 15-day period, then representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, Mark Pocan, Bernie Sanders proposed a series of bills to halt these transactions and to halt this transaction, $735 million commercial sale. On May 13th, representatives Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, Cori Bush, Rashida Tlaib and others in the squad gathered in the U.S. Congress and publicly expressed support for the Palestinian people. And they called for an end to funding Israeli military aggression. And that was a big deal. We had never seen something like this done on the floor. And I think even newcomer Representative Mary Newman called on the State Department to condemn the ethnic cleansing of Sheikh Jarrah as a violation of international law. And they used terms in both cases, like apartheid, to describe Israel as a state. Again, language never before spoken in those halls by people in power. And those words were inherited from years of grassroots organizing, advocacy work, and solidarity initiatives on behalf of the Palestinian people and their right to self-determination, our right to self-determination. Also, the presentation, when I think about Cori Bush, for example, you know, she connected militarized policing, anti-war movements. They connected anti-occupation, anti-apartheid with social justice and collective liberation, with Palestinian liberation. And the so-called United States grassroots movements of Palestine supporters have taken to the streets en masse across all major cities this summer and late spring. And they called out the grotesque imbalance of power and poking holes in the stale peace discourse that distracts from Israeli military aggression, expanding systems of control, and all the racist tropes that combine Palestinian resistance to terrorism. And they fit us within a standard that Israel does not confine itself to, and the U.S. would never hold Israel to, right? This is the obvious double standard between the support of the colonizer and the colonized. And so I think online and social media campaigns that have critiqued the U.S. direct contribution to the onslaught against Palestinians has also demanded that political representatives do something about this. And so the U.S. blank check to Israel has been particularly front and center in terms of folks bringing it forward and saying, this is ridiculous. We have to do something. I did want to highlight briefly back to the Abraham Accords, specifically some examples that we can extrapolate from that first-rate weapons deal. So for example, just to bring in the Arab states, the United Arab Emirates publicly noted upon signing the deal that they were expecting 50 F-35 fighter jets and 18 armed Reaper drones as part of the $23.37 billion U.S. dollar arms deal approved by the Trump administration. And so all of this is in exchange for normalization. This is a massive military package, $23.37 billion. And the prospect of Arab countries receiving the same caliber of weapons as the Israeli state most certainly was a motivator for normalization by those same states. And I think what's important is that it wove these Arab nations into the central support for Israeli security and hegemony in the region. And that alone puts them in direct contradiction with Palestine and aspirations for Palestinian freedom. These Arab countries have publicly signed themselves up to serve U.S. and Israeli interests in the region at large. And so when we continue and we say, okay, we have this massive military package being offered to the UAE and then also Bahrain, and then we add the $735 million commercial sale to Israel that was proposed in May. Aside from that commercial deal, the U.S. is also scheduled to send $3.3 billion to Israel in foreign military financing, or FMF, and an additional $500 million for joint U.S.-Israeli research, development, and deployment of a missile defense system. And then in June, Israel was forecasted to request U.S. Congress for another $1 billion to restock the Iron Dome and to upgrade the system, which would put the FMF at $4.3 billion. There have not been any developments to my knowledge at this time, but we are watching what is happening. So I think, Yara, it seems that Americans are realizing that this money is going in droves to violence against and direct onslaught against Palestinians. And they are also becoming aware that this package to Israel and Arab nations, normalizing Arab nations, is also going to oppress other people in the region. So if we look at why some of these weapons are being stockpiled, we can see that they are being used to further the crisis in Yemen and also as part of an ongoing regional calculation against Iran. And so I think that for U.S. representatives and for the U.S. political system, they have to understand that support for Israel by them and by the United States is not just costly in terms of financial responsibilities. I just, you know, listed out some whopping sums. It's expensive to upkeep this military might and hegemony, but it also has the potential to become politically costly as well, both in domestic politics and on the international scale. So while the projected numbers for military aid to Israel only go upwards, public opinion is actually shifting, and U.S. residents in the global community are demanding accountability. Finally, in May, the Los Angeles Times or LA Times referenced a Gallup study reporting a massive surge in support for Palestine over the past decade, moving from 1 in 7 Americans primarily sympathizing with Palestine to now 1 in 4. I think the United States representatives who stepped forward and many of those who did not need to account for this shift in public support and position when it comes to the Palestinian people.
I think it's really important to note, as you did, Nadia, in your answer, that the squad questioning US military support, the use of words such as apartheid in the halls of Congress, this is not just random, or this has not just happened overnight, but rather that this is on the back of years, if not decades, of organizing by Palestinians and their allies. And it's also linked to joining Palestinian struggle up with other justice movements. And I think that's incredibly important. And I think it's also incredibly important, as you did, to link these weapons deals with other weapons deals, that these normalization agreements is not just a betrayal of the Palestinian struggle, but it's also the beginning of a new era of massive human rights abuses across the region, which will be funded and bankrolled by the US. And I was quite hit by that statistic that you mentioned at the end of your intervention, when you noted that whereas previously 1 in 7 Americans had been in support of the Palestinian struggle, and now it's 1 in 4. And that's quite massive. And that, along with everything else that's going on, seems to be quite a transformational moment in the history of Palestinian solidarity and critique of Israel, certainly in the US. So I wanted to ask you how you think this can be galvanized upon in the struggle for Palestinian rights.
Certainly, Yara. I know that there are mass campaigns in the works going directly at military aid and militarism itself. So we've seen a few preliminary mobilizations against Boeing in the city of Chicago, for example, who are direct manufacturers of F-35s and precision missiles being sold to Israel and normalizing Arab nations. They also happen to hold a contract with the city of Chicago that's up for renewal this year. People came out en masse to say they don't want the contract to be renewed with their city. Other targets, such as Raytheon, Elbit, General Dynamics, they also contribute to the running of F-35 fighter jets, F-16s. And it's clear that anti-militarism is something that many movements can get behind. These systems of control and destruction, as we've both mentioned here, extended in far beyond Palestine. Boeing sales to the Philippines, for example, facilitate gruesome repression of people's and peasants' movements there. And Elbit systems are complicit in creating the infrastructure right now for the U.S.-Mexico border apparatus, which exacerbates violence to incoming migrants and native communities along the border, and so many people every day. Elbit is part of building that out. And so I think we have to see the impacts that these weapon manufacturers are having on different movements, and also call into question U.S. military aid period. The People's Embargo, for example, is a grassroots and NGO-linked initiative coming out of the Palestine Solidarity Movement and Anti-Militarism Partnership. And it's growing. It's offering a vision to coordinate advocacy opportunities with grassroots campaigns and a container for organizing direct action. At its best, it would target multiple aspects of the military aid and weapons manufacturing machine. I think in terms of advocacy opportunities with actual material impacts on the Israeli occupation, we've seen some major developments. So in the spring and early summer of this year, you know, we have the resolutions put forward against the $735 million commercial sale. In November, members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, led by Robert Menendez out of New Jersey, introduced a series of resolutions against the weapon sale and buttressed Israel's qualitative military edge. Ilhan Omar of Minnesota also countered the pending weapons deal under the Abraham Accords with a stronger wording to ban the sale altogether, citing the UAE human rights violations. Representative McCollum of Minnesota also submitted her HR 2590 on April 15th, which is the bill to defend the human rights of Palestinian children and families living under Israeli military occupation act. And it was signed by over 17 other representatives. And that bill really aims to ensure that U.S. funding is not used to sustain Israeli military judicial system and forced displacement of Palestinians through home demolitions and evictions and illegal annexations of Palestinian land. So I think that we should interpret these bills presented in courageous times as part of the genealogy of, yes, our people's movements and their resonance and impacts in Congress, but also as part of a different genealogy, which is the Leahy Law, which provides the foundation of conditioning military aid due to human rights violations. And so I think McCollum's bill in particular comes as part of a growing movement to condition U.S. aid to Israel, meaning to halt U.S. aid to Israel in response to carrying out sweeping human rights abuses. You know, additionally, Reps Bernie Sanders or even Elizabeth Warren have openly confirmed their willingness to restrict U.S. aid to Israel, meaning to withhold money from any Israeli institution or military branch that are responsible for those human rights abuses. And the issue with this model, I think, is the extreme fungibility of Israel's aid and their ability to just shuffle funds between departments and bodies of their choosing because they receive so much U.S. assistance in cash. So on top of that, most lawmakers will never hold Israel's military actions to the same standard or rubric that they will continue to hold other countries in the region accountable to. So there's the much less political will, I should say, to condition military aid because they would never label Israeli colonial violence as a human rights violation. But we know that things are moving considerably, and so that certainly shouldn't be taken off the table. But I am very much speaking to the context that we're in now, not what we're hoping for, not our aspirations. But I think, Yara, the point is that Israel continues to be exceptionalized. So as Saleh Booker mentions from the Center for International Policy, he points out that Israel is the only country in the world for which the United States does not track which weapons go to which military unit, which makes it virtually impossible to enforce the Leahy Law requirements that prohibit using funds for assistance to foreign forces implicated in human rights violations. And so I think with all that said, nevertheless, as Boeing and military companies are put in the spotlight through these citywide campaigns and hopefully through many more coming, when we see mass political will reflected on the floor of the Senate, we are called to seriously look into the S in boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and to increase our demands for material shifts to U.S. aid. Grassroots organizers and advocates for Palestine are called upon by Palestinians at home to put together a plan to mitigate more U.S. funding and harm. And conditioning and restricting aid to Israel as an expansion of this S, of the sanctions, in a way we haven't seen before. I think it's clear that discourse around peace deals serves as a distraction from real and unwavering Israeli military aggression and expanding systems of control. And I see that more and more grassroots organizers and advocates are calling that out. I think we must ask ourselves as people on the left, as progressives, if sanctions can ever be an acceptable tool of the left to push back against an ally of the United States itself. Can sanctions break apart from an oppressive tool of the right, which uses them to devastate U.S. adversaries globally? So I think that if we ever need inspiration for the fight moving forward, we should always look to the grassroots and to the people's movements who struggle against these systems of oppression and who are struggling against these systems of imperialism from the United States, as if it were common sense, because realistically, it absolutely is. And we have made huge advances in pushing back against the business as usual U.S. military aid and direct weapon sales to the Israeli state to be used as part of repression on the ground in Palestine. And so I think we have been able to achieve some major, at least narrative gains, and manufacture also political will in our representatives in a way that we previously have not even thought were possible.
Nadia, thank you so much for joining me. I could keep talking to you about this topic. I think you brought up some really important questions and some certainly some things that I haven't thought about before, namely questioning whether sanctions can be used as a tool for the left. And I think it's, you know, also important to stress that things like Betty McCollum's bill is not, you know, particularly radical. It doesn't ask for Israel to stop incarcerating and torturing children. It just asks that US taxpayers' dollars don't go towards incarcerating and torturing Palestinian children. And so I think, you know, I think that puts it into perspective a little bit on how much work is left to be done, certainly in these institutional spaces. And questions actually do arise whether we can actually use these spaces and how much energy should be put into those spaces. So thank you again so much for joining me. And you mentioned several times throughout this podcast, the policy brief, which you're writing for Shabaka, which will be published very soon. And we look forward to that so much. So for those listening, please keep your eyes peeled.
Yara, I love that you said that, because I think a big question here is how much can you ask of a settler colonial state itself to regulate the actions of another settler colonial state? How much can we really ask of a state that's born out of occupation and imperialism to contain or manage any imperial interest abroad? It is indeed their nature to support it.
Nadia, thank you so much for that final but important comment.
Thank you, Yara.
Thank you for listening to Rethinking Palestine. For more policy analysis and to donate to support our work, please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
So that's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
It takes a good dose of courage and perseverance to get through a pandemic.
True, but it also takes a good dose of patience, resilience, confidence, optimism, humor, and love. Not to mention a dose of determination, endurance, empathy, motivation, hope, and ingenuity.
But above all, it takes a second dose of vaccine.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Yeah. Fashion shows, fancy clothes. That's just the way it goes.
So I'm still eating chicken wings. Versatile, so I can keep switching lanes. I got plenty chains, I got plenty rings. Ain't nothing to a queen, you ain't said a thing. Bet I Jim Carrey, bet they bite the slang. Like to call him necklace, cause he wanna hang. He was going nuts, so I let him hang.
Fashion shows, fancy clothes. That's just the way it goes.